Part 3. Reality. Chapter 9. The Courage to Do the Right Thing. Know when to break the rules.
How many souls on board? The air traffic controller asked. As if we were still traversing the globe in wooden ships with tall masts, the archaic terminology referring to the number of people aboard the vessel is a standard question asked when an aircraft declares an in-flight emergency.
126 souls, replied the pilot.
The Florida-bound flight was somewhere over Maryland, at an altitude of 36,000 feet, traveling at about 560 miles per hour, when smoke started to pour into the cockpit. Smoke on board an aircraft is one of the most terrifying emergencies a pilot will ever face. They don't always know the cause of the smoke. They don't know if there is a fire. They don't know if the emergency is contained or if it's going to spread, and spread out of control quickly. The smoke itself can make seeing or breathing difficult, and it is sure to cause panic among the passengers. No matter how you look at it, it's bad.
Center, KH-209, the pilot radioed when he realized the problem.
KH-209, go ahead, replied the controller monitoring the airspace.
KH-209, I need to descend immediately. I can't maintain altitude, was the abrupt call from the pilot.
But there was a problem. There was another flight also flying to Florida, 2,000 feet directly below the troubled aircraft. The FAA rules are simple enough. No two aircraft flying en route may pass each other any closer than 1,000 feet above or below, or 5 miles around each other. The rules are there for good reason. Traveling at 3/4 the speed of sound, it becomes very difficult to maneuver aircraft without creating a serious risk of collision. To make matters worse, the two planes were flying in a narrow route toward their destination. Because of a military exercise that was going on in the area, the airspace was restricted to a narrow band, much like the lane of a highway. And though there were other lanes on this highway, there was other traffic in them at the time. The air traffic controller replied to the pilot's request to descend immediately. KH-209, turn 15 degrees right and descend. Not only had the air traffic controller ordered the distressed airplane to enter restricted airspace, but telling the pilot to descend would mean he would pass well within the 5-mile buffer of the plane flying beneath him. Modern airplanes are equipped with collision alarms that alert a pilot when another airplane flies within that 1,000-foot, 5-mile buffer. When the alarm sounds, knowing the limited time they have, pilots are trained to react to what could be an impending disaster. The proximity by which these two planes would pass each other, 2 miles to be exact, would surely set off the collision alarm of the flight traveling at 34,000 feet, and that would create another problem. But this was a very experienced air traffic controller sitting at the console that day. He was fully aware of all the aircraft in the area. What's more, he was very aware of all the rules and restrictions. He radioed the pilot of the other aircraft and spoke in very clear, plain English. AG 1446, there is an airplane flying above you. He has declared an emergency. He's going to descend through your altitude at approximately 2 miles off your right front. He needs to descend immediately. This same message would be repeated again as the troubled vessel passed through the airspace of another 3 aircraft as it made its way down. On that clear day over Maryland, 126 souls were saved because one very experienced air traffic controller decided to break the rules. Keeping people alive was more important than maintaining boundaries. There were over 9.8 million scheduled domestic and passenger flights on U.S. airlines in 2012. That's nearly 26,800 flights per day. The numbers are staggering. These numbers don't even include the unscheduled cargo and foreign flights that crisscross America every year. More than 815 million passengers each year entrust their lives to the pilots who transport us, the mechanics who ensure the aircraft are airworthy, and the FAA, which develops the regulations to ensure everything runs as safely as possible. And then there are the air traffic controllers. We trust these relatively few people to obey the rules to ensure that all those aircraft are kept moving safely across the skies. But in the case of Flight KH-209, the controller broke the rules. He disobeyed the clear line set to ensure our safety. And that's what trust is. We don't just trust people to obey the rules, we also trust that they know when to break them. The rules are there for normal operations. The rules are designed to avoid danger and help ensure that things go smoothly. And though there are guidelines for how to deal with emergencies, at the end of the day, we trust the expertise of a special few people to know when to break the rules. Organizations that offer people an opportunity to fully commit work tirelessly to train their people. This goes beyond the occasional class on how to write a better PowerPoint or be a more effective presenter. These organizations offer endless opportunities for self-improvement. The more training they offer us, the more we learn. The more experienced and confident we become, the more the organization is willing to give us greater and greater responsibility. And ultimately, the organization, our management, and our colleagues is willing to trust us to know when to break the rules. We cannot trust rules or technology. We can rely on them for sure, but trust them? No. Trust is a very special human experience, produced by the chemical oxytocin in response to acts performed on our behalf that serve our safety and protection. True trust can only exist among people, and we can only trust others when we know that they are actively and consciously concerned about us. A technology, no matter how sophisticated, doesn't care about us at all. It simply reacts to a set of variables. And the rulebook, no matter how comprehensive, cannot consider every eventuality. Imagine if every time we had a fight with a loved one, they reacted to a set of variables or deferred to the rulebook for advice. How long do you think that relationship would last? This is the reason we find bureaucrats infuriating. They simply default to the rules with no consideration for the people those rules were designed to help or protect. In other words, they don't care. There is no algorithm for a successful relationship between people or with companies. The true social benefit of trust must be reciprocal. One-way trust is not beneficial to the individual or the group. What good is a company in which management trusts labor, but labor doesn't trust the management? It is hardly a strong marriage in which the wife trusts the husband, but the husband doesn't trust the wife. It's all fine and good for a leader to expect the people to trust them, but if the leader doesn't trust the people, the system will fail. For trust to serve the individuals and the group, it must be shared. The responsibility of leaders is to teach their people the rules, train them to gain competency, and build their confidence. At that point, leadership must step back and trust that their people know what they are doing and will do what needs to be done. In weak organizations, without oversight, too many people will break the rules for personal gain. That's what makes these organizations weak. In strong organizations, people will break the rules because it is the right thing to do for others. Think about it. Would you feel comfortable watching your family board a plane, knowing there was a qualified pilot or controller who will do everything by the book no matter what? Would you let your family get on a plane, knowing that the pilot or air traffic controller cared only about what they need to do to get their next bonus? Or would you rather watch your family board a plane, knowing there were confident pilots and controllers with lots of experience who will know what rules to break if something should go wrong, possibly putting their bonus at risk as a result? The answer is so plainly obvious. We don't trust rules. We trust people. The responsibility of a leader is to provide cover from above for their people who are working below. When the people feel that they have control to do what's right, even if it sometimes means breaking the rules, then they will more likely do the right thing. Courage comes from above. Our confidence to do what's right is determined by how trusted we feel by our leaders. If good people are asked to work in a bad culture, one in which leaders do not relinquish control, then the odds of something bad happening go up. People will be more concerned about following the rules out of fear of getting in trouble or losing their jobs than doing what needs to be done. And when that happens, souls will be lost. Chapter 10. The Snowmobile in the Desert. Let's face it, we're good. We're really good. I mean, we're the best thing that ever lived. This is not the ramblings of an egomaniac. Just look at the world around us. Other animals just go about their days, looking for food, procreating, and operating on instinct. But not us. We do so much more than operate to survive or grow our population, though we will do that as well. We invent, build, and achieve things unachievable by any other species on the planet. Gazelles didn't build the pyramids. We did. Gorillas didn't figure out the combustion engine. We did. And it's all because of our remarkable neocortex, the part of our brain that separates us from the other mammals. It is our neocortex that gives us the ability to think rationally and critically about the world and solve complex problems. It is because of our neocortex that we can speak and communicate in a way vastly more sophisticated than any other species on the planet. It is this ability that allows us, among many other things,
to pass on our lessons to others so that they don't need to relearn everything we've learned. Each generation is able to build on the lessons of the previous generations so that we can make real progress in the world. This is what it means to be human. We are achievement machines. However, as great as our neocortex is at helping us get things done, it is our primitive limbic brain that controls our feelings, our ability to trust, our ability to cooperate, our ability to socialize and build strong communities. It is our limbic brain that feeds the gut reactions and gut decisions that drive our behavior. It gives us the ability to form strong emotional bonds with others, and these strong social bonds allow us to work together to do all the things our Homo sapien neocortices can dream up. If we weren't able to trust each other and work together, no matter how smart we were, we would die young and alone. We would never feel the joy of being in relationships, have the feeling of being in a circle of people with whom we share the same values and beliefs, or the intense feeling of goodness that comes from doing something for someone else. As much as we like to think that it is our smarts that get us ahead, it is not everything. Our intelligence gives us ideas and instructions, but it is our ability to cooperate that actually helps us get those things done. Nothing of real value on this earth was ever built by one person without the help of others. There are few accomplishments, companies, or technologies that were built by one person without the help or support of anyone else. It is clear that the more others want to help us, the more we can achieve. And it is our ability to get things done that has produced one of the greatest paradoxes of the modern era. In our pursuit to advance, we have, without intending to, built a world that is making it harder and harder for us to cooperate. The symptoms of this cruel irony are easy to feel in the developed world. Feelings of isolation and high stress have fueled industries that are profiting from our search for happiness. Self-help books, courses, and any number of pharmaceuticals make up multi-billion-dollar industries designed to help us find that elusive happiness, or, at the very least, to reduce our stress. In only a few decades, the self-help business alone has grown to $11 billion. The biggest thing the self-help industry seems to have helped is itself. Our search for happiness and connection has also led us to seek professional advice. In the 1950s, few of us went to weekly sessions with a therapist. Today, in the U.S., according to the Hoover Institute, there are 77,000 clinical psychologists, 192,000 clinical social workers, 105,000 mental health counselors, 50,000 marriage and family therapists, 17,000 nurse psychotherapists, and 30,000 life coaches. The only reason the field continues to grow is because of increasing demand. The more we try to make ourselves feel better, the worse we seem to feel. That only a minority of employees feel fulfilled and truly happy at work is our own doing. We have built systems and constructed organizations that force the human animal to work in environments in which it does not work best. With an excess of dopamine to drive us and cortisol flowing when we don't need it, we have actually short-circuited our system to do the opposite, to encourage us to look out for ourselves first and be suspicious of others. If the human being is a snowmobile, this means we are designed to operate in very specific conditions. Take the machine designed for one kind of condition, snow, and put it in another condition, the desert, for example, and it won't operate as well. Sure, the snowmobile will go, it just won't go as easily or as well as if it were in the right conditions. This is what has happened in many of our modern organizations. And when progress is slow or innovation is lacking, leaders tinker with the machine. They hire and fire in hopes of getting the right mix. They develop new kinds of incentives to encourage the machine to work harder. With an incentivizing cocktail of dopamine, the machines will indeed work harder and maybe even go a little faster in the desert. But the friction is great. What too many leaders of organizations fail to appreciate is that it's not the people that are the problem. The people are fine. Rather, it's the environment in which the people operate that is the problem. Get that right and things just go. To a social animal, trust is like lubrication. It reduces friction and creates conditions much more conducive to performance, just like putting the snowmobile back in the snow. Do that, and even an underpowered snowmobile will run circles around the most powerful snowmobile in the wrong conditions. It's not how smart the people in the organization are. It's how well they work together that is the true indicator of future success or the ability to manage through struggle. Trust and commitment are feelings that we get from the release of chemical incentives deep in our limbic brain. And as such, they are inherently hard to measure. Just as we can't simply tell someone to be happy and expect them to be happy, we can't just tell someone to trust us or to commit to something and expect they will. There are all sorts of things we need to do first before someone will feel any sense of loyalty or devotion. There are some basic tenets that all leaders of organizations must obey to build deep trust and commitment among the people who work for them. And in a very undopamine way, it will take time, energy, and the will of people for these things to work. All this begs the question, how did we get ourselves into the desert in the first place?